dear beloved mother used to say that if you live long enough, there's no limit to what you may experience. And for me, this talk today is a new experience. And I must admit, a little embarrassing one. I have no problem with the first part of the title of this talk, Narrative Theory. It's familiar ground, though I'm always happy to revisit it. Problem is with the second part, the personal retrospective. Partly because I'm not used to speaking in the autobiographical mode. To my mind, private things are best kept private. And partly because a personal retrospect is, I think, a little premature. The Greeks used to say, never call a man happy until he's dead. What they meant was that you can look back on a career, on a life, only when it's finished. Because while there's life, there may always be changes which may change the picture. And I, for one, hope that in the rest of my life, I'm still going to change the picture. So it's a problem, it's early days, but the organizers, those two gentlemen here, have talked me into it, and since I agreed, I take all the responsibility and will do my best. Now, since I just quoted the Greeks, let me quote from the ancient Jewish sages. They said, if you want to lose your money, do a lot of jobs. Engage in a lot of things. In other words, the advice was, concentrate your energies, specialize. It's very good advice. But have I followed it? No and yes. No, at least on the surface, because I have worked on a very wide front. As we distributed, as this selected list of publications will indicate, I have worked, for example, on verbal art and other semiotic codes. I worked on, in literature itself, on ancient literature, my great love, the Bible, the greatest narrative work ever written, Homer, and others, the ancient Greek historians. And I've worked on the Middle Ages, and I've worked on the classical novel, and I've worked on modernism. And within these, I've worked on various problems that to my mind needed some treatment or revisiting and so forth. So on the face of it, I've gone against the advice of the rabbis. But on the other hand, no, I haven't gone against it, because the things are all connected in my head. Every single thing that I've done is connected, and now I can do what I couldn't do, say, 15 years ago or 20 years ago, and also explain that connection in the form of two laws of communication of discourse that I've formulated. I've always sensed them. As I'll specify a little later, even as a student, I sensed those laws, but I formulated them over the years. And before I specify them, Let me say that when I say laws, I mean laws in the hardest possible sense. Not norms, not tendencies, not statistical frequencies, but laws. Laws of discourse, which to my mind are comparable to the laws of nature. That is a high claim, but I should try to make it good. Those two laws are, one is what I call the law of reciprocity, and the other is the Proteus principle. And these two together run throughout my work. Now, let me first explain those laws and then illustrate them. I can't illustrate them in sufficient detail, but I'll try to give a sense of them, especially as they relate to narrative theory. First, the law of reciprocity. The law of reciprocity says that whatever has been expressed or is expressible can be explained. Now, the reciprocity, therefore, is the reciprocity of operation between the two ends of communication. The transmitting end, or the expressing end, and the receiving end, the explaining end. What the one end can transmit or has transmitted, the other end can explain. Now, this law may sound simple, perhaps even self-evident. And if it sounds so to you, I am delighted. Really and truly delighted, because this means that you are with me, or I am with you, against one of the strongest and, to my mind, most counterproductive traditions in discourse analysis. A tradition that spreads over several disciplines of that. Find it in linguistics, in pragmatics, in various kinds of discourse or branches of discourse analysis, in the philosophy of language, and in the literary followers and parallels. What is common to them all is actually an approach or a premise that is opposed to the law of reciprocity, because it brands certain discourses or pieces of discourse, it brands them as unacceptable with various synonyms. Sometimes it's ungrammatical, sometimes it's semantically nonsensical, sometimes it's unsayable or unspeakable, sometimes it's unreadable, unnarratable, untellable, and so forth. And I'll exemplify in a minute. Now, this whole tradition originates in logic. Philosophical logic or mathematical logic, they are the same in this regard. And the point is that in logic, this binarism of the acceptable and the non-acceptable or the unacceptable is valid. Logic is the place, and to my mind, the only place for this binarism. Take an example. Take a simple syllogism. Okay? All my neighbors are lovable. Mary is my neighbor, therefore Mary is lovable. This is a valid syllogism, right? There is the major premise, there is the minor premise, and the conclusion follows by necessity, by logical necessity, from those premises. On the other hand, Mary, all my neighbors are lovable. Mary is lovable, therefore Mary is my neighbor. We have the same structure on the face of it, but this time the syllogism is invalid because there may be people who are lovable but are not my neighbors, and Mary may be one of them. So this illustrates, so to speak, the logic of logic. That is, logic cuts up its arguments, or any actual or possible argument in logic, cuts them up into two. There are the valid arguments and there are the invalid arguments. But as I said, logic is the only place for such binarism, the only place where, in a way, the law of reciprocity is, as it were, suspended. The trouble is that the appeal of logic, the prestige of logic, is so strong that this binarism has been applied to other domains where it does not hold, and where it sometimes goes against the grain of the discourse in question. Now, one of the most famous extensions is, of course, Chomsky's division of sentences this time, not arguments, of sentences, into grammatical ones and ungrammatical ones. An ungrammatical sentence is one pronounced to be such, for example, by a native speaker of the language. Now, this binarism, as you probably know, this binarism was soon relaxed and reformed and qualified by the linguists themselves, because it very soon turned out, which is of course to be expected, that what is grammatical in one dialect, for example, of the language, is not grammatical in another dialect. And finally, it came to it that people spoke about their personal dialects as being the determinant of grammaticality or ungrammaticality, the idiolects. So, problems started, and as I said, they are expected. But the language system is, from our point of view, the least problematic area. What interests us is discourse. That is not language, but language in action, language in use. And there, neither logic nor linguistics apply. Now, let me be very careful about this. I don't speak as an enemy of logic and linguistics. Actually, I've been trained in both. What I'm saying is that the conceptual tools of these disciplines have a very limited application to discourse, largely because of the law of reciprocity. We must remember that not only is language only one component of discourse. Obviously, another component, no less important, many would say more important, is the world, for example, that is represented by the language. And when when discourse represents worlds, linguistics, or linguists as such, have no special expertise in analysis. What they say and what the man in the street says is of equal value in principle. Now, the trouble is that both of these disciplines, language, linguistics, and language, sometimes together, sometimes apart, have been taken as a model by discourse analysts, including analysts of literary discourse. And then this binary cut of the acceptable versus the unacceptable has been misapplied. Let me bring one example that I have analyzed in detail in, if you look at the, at your list of selected list of publications, number 44 in a long article called Factives and Perspectives, Making Sense of Presupposition as Exemplary Inference. Now, I don't know if you know this this type of inference, so let me quickly present it and link it to my topic and this law. In 1950, one of the most important philosophers of language, P.S. Strawson, discovered a new type of inference, and he called it presupposition. Now, the discovery arose in a quarrel he had with a classical essay on reference by Bertrand Russell, written as early as 1905. And you will be happy to learn that the bone of contention, the example over which they quarreled, was the present King of France is bald. Now, Bertrand, very briefly, Bertrand Russell's analysis of this sentence was this. He says, the sentence states two things. One, that there is at present a king of France. Second, that the king is bald. Since there is no king of France at present, that statement is false. Thus, Russell. Strawson objected. He said that this statement does not state the existence of the present King of France. It only implies it. Or, the term he introduced, presupposes it. And therefore, the statement, including this phrase, is neither true nor false. The whole question of truth and falsity fails to arise. It is, in other words, unacceptable, and uses beautifully expressive language to describe it. He says that whenever we have an inconsistency in language, such as this, the inconsistency of the phrase with reality, it's as if you take a walk and then you come back. Now, this has all been an exercise. You've gone nowhere. Similarly, when you say such a sentence, you exercise your vocal cords. You have expressed nothing. But if we look at this sentence, is this sentence unacceptable? Nonsensical in some sense? I think that especially literary scholars will find no difficulty in making sense of this sentence. For example, if we think of a context in which this sentence is spoken by a royalist who still believes that there are kings, there is a king of France, and I'm sure, I mean, I don't know his the present candidate, but you must know there is somewhere a king of France, and therefore this king of France can be said to be bald. Moreover, we have, even if there is none, no such claimant, then if we put round this sentence, we put the frame of fictionality, no problem. The sentence makes sense within the fiction, because fiction can postulate its own premises. If you like, we can find even other more poetic, in a sense, explanations. For example, as we know, literature delights in paradoxes, in unsolvable paradoxes. One of my favorites is, if you remember Alice in Wonderland, the Mad Tea Party, when Alice crashes into that tea party and the Mad Hatter asks, says, would you like me to pose a riddle to you? And she says, yes, I like riddles. And then he says, you remember, why is a raven like a writing desk? And she thinks, and she gives up, and she says, I don't know. What is the answer? And he says, I don't know either. So it is a kind of riddle, for a riddle for the riddle's sake, but as we know, it has a long tradition in the tradition of paradoxes in literature. That may be another answer, that is, this internal inconsistency may be designed by literature for a certain effect. Or if you like, you may say that this sentence has not been chosen for its sense, but for its sound. The present king of France is bold. Four arms, right? So it rhymes, it makes sense, not on the semantic level, but on the prosodic level. This exemplifies in miniature what I meant by the law of reciprocity. The branding of a statement, of a piece of discourse, or of a whole discourse, or is unacceptable, is itself, I mean, if there's something unacceptable, it is this. Because first of all, what does it mean, unacceptable? It's there, right? We meet it on the page, or it's spoken to us, even in everyday discourse. What do you mean unacceptable? We must accept it. And the point is that once we do accept it, we can always make sense of it. And this is an extreme example, because it drives the problem to the extreme so-called unacceptability, inconsistency, apparent self-contradiction. But let me give another example within presupposition that will perhaps touch on something more familiar to you. I won't reveal in advance, but we'll come to it in a minute. Now, the family of presuppositions includes, apart from presumptions of existence like this, which are attached to noun phrases, includes a very interesting phenomenon called fictivity. For example, if I say, she knew that the earth was round, that would be, according to the pragmaticists, to the Strawsons and his heirs, by the way, presupposition is together with Greitz's inference implicature is the most studied inference over the last 50 years. When I wrote this article, I counted, I think I read everything in it that was published up to that time, and it was over 300 items, 300 studies. So according to this tradition, this would be acceptable, but if we change round by flat, we would have an unacceptable factive expression. Why? Because of the fictivity. In other words, according through the receipt theory. Effective verb, like new, differs from non-effective verbs, like, for example, here, believed. Right? She believed that the earth was flat. Doesn't cause any problem, because it's her belief. And she may be mad and misinformed and so forth. But she knew that the earth was flat becomes problematic, because when I use, suppose I'm the speaker of the sentence, she knew that the earth was flat, when I use the verb know, then I am committed, I commit myself to the truth of the proposition in the subordinate clause. That is, it's not only she who is committed to this proposition, but I am as well. I endorse it. Or if you like to put it from the reader's side, when we readers come across this statement, then we infer from it, here comes the inference part, we infer from it the speaker's commitment to the statement. In other words, the commitment, the speaker does two things. That he states a truth about the world, for example, about the nature of the earth, and he makes another statement, a subjective statement, in attributing it to her mind. He does both together. Now, when the statement is false, according to the usual analysis, then the presupposition fails and the statement becomes unacceptable. Now, regarding the earlier example, is that the case? Now, and by the way, before I proceed, let me emphasize that not only is no, it's a real problem, not only is no one of the most important verbs in the language, but that the effective set of expressions of verbs includes other most important verbs. It includes, for example, understand. It includes realize. It includes an expression like it is surprising that, it is odd that, and so forth. So it's in this sense, it's a quite general question. And what I'm going to say applies to the whole category. Now, against this analysis, which pronounces this as unacceptable as the present King of France is bald, I would suggest that first of all, we note what has not been noted in the traditional approaches, and that is that this sentence, this statement, is a quotation. It is a quotation in that I enter her mind and quote the thoughts in that mind, or at least the one thought about the earth. In this, it does not vary from any other quoting construction in indirect discourse. The structure is the same as she said that the earth was flat, she believed that the earth was flat, and so forth. With one exception, that the reporting clause is practical. In other words, commits the speaker as well as the subject, commits me, if I speak it, as well as her, to the truth of that statement. First, it's a quotation. And if it's a quotation, then like all quotations, this is a universal quotation, it contains a perspectival montage. other words, it brings together at least two perspectives, two viewpoints, two voices. One of them, the voice of the subject of the thought, she who thinks this, and the other viewpoint is mine as reporter, as the maker of that inside view, the penetrator into the mind. And like all perspectival montages, and I use this term advisedly, we can't tell in advance what belongs to whom in the given quotation, in the given quoted discourse. In other words, since we have two perspectives, what have I contributed to this piece of discourse, and what has she contributed? What has she originally thought? Now, perhaps this, in this example, you don't see the richness of the interplay. But imagine another example, also with this factor. Suppose the example is, Natasha knew that her husband was a KGB bastard. Okay? Natasha knew that her husband was a KGB bastard. Now here, we see that the problem thickens. Why? First of all, if she's called Natasha and her husband is a KGB man, probably she didn't think in English, right? So, I contributed the language, I translated her thought into English. That's my contribution, the reporter's contribution, the quoter's. Now, if you take the inset phrase, did she in her mind think of that guy as her husband? Or did she think of him as Sasha? Or it's thought, she doesn't even have to name him as he. Which means that I have contributed in reporting her thought, I have contributed the referring expression as well. And finally, does she judge him to be a bastard? Or does she think of him, she says, in her mind, she thought, Sasha is a KGB man, and it is my contribution to the discourse, the value judgment, bastard, and so forth. I think this exemplifies the montage. That is, in every quotation, direct, indirect, free indirect, in this case, we seem to have an indirect quotation. In every quotation, what we get is a montage of viewpoints, a montage of perspectives, and we have to unpack that montage by inference. It's never given. Then we may have internal indicators like those I mentioned. Is the judge, to whom does the judgment suit? The reporter or the reportee? Whom does this referring term suit? And sometimes there are contextual pointers as well, which may lead us to a certain unpacking or may mislead us about a certain unpacking. Now, when we approach our problematic sentence from this viewpoint, we can see that when viewed or reviewed as a quotation and hence a montage, we can find an answer to the problem, which will draw it out of unacceptability and the way should be. I mean, to those who know the theory of reported discourse, should be easy enough. That is, why do we have to assume that this is an indirect quotation? That is, if we assume that it is an indirect quotation, then we assume that she originally thought the earth is flat, and that I added the reporting sentence, and I turned it into the third person in making the indirect quotation. But why shouldn't we read it as a free indirect quotation, as a stil and direct libre? Then what we would have is that she originally thought, I know that the earth is round. And we come across such statements all over the place. I mean, once I invite you to start looking for them, I promise you in the next book you'll find them. Let me cite a context. I had to go to bed. I knew that I wouldn't fall asleep. I woke up the next morning at 10 o'clock. Now, once I supply the context, it's clear. That is, actually, after I went to bed, I said to myself, I know, and sometimes the know is even emphasized in your text. It's emphasized to leave no doubt about the attribution of it, not to the narrator, but to that character who is going to go to sleep. Then we have the flat contradiction. He woke up. So if we have missed the free indirectness while we're reading in sequence, we realize it in retrospect. In other words, we then hypothesize the free indirect discourse in order to resolve the contradiction between the supposed presupposition that he wasn't going to fall asleep and the fact that he not only fell asleep but got up late in the morning. So in this way, what happens then is we simply redistribute the perspectival montage. The no belongs then not to me, the reporter. It's not I who stand behind the factive. It belongs to her. She stands committed to that statement, and I merely report it. In other words, what this retains is the commissive force of presupposition. The commissive force of presupposition doesn't evaporate. It simply shifts perspectives from the perspective of the reporter, myself in this case, to the perspective of the reportee, to her mind. And by this, the sentence, of course, makes sense. It's perfectly acceptable because, well, as long as I am not committed to a patent absurdity, to a falsity, she may believe what she likes. And certainly so if, for example, we add a context where this is said by me, not today, but is said by me in the Middle Ages, right? When the earth being flat would make perfect sense even in my own terms as well as in hers. So, the point is that 50 years of branding such statements as unacceptable are based simply on a misreading of the examples, and what is more important, on a mistaken premise that things that are expressed in discourse may defeat explanation. There is no such thing. And by the way, if you exercise your ingenuity, I'm certain that you can find explanations that do not make sense of this in terms of presupposition, as I did just now. That is, I kept the presupposition in force, only I shifted it, the committive force, from myself to her, but you can make other explanations like we explain this in terms of a deliberate paradox, or we explain this in terms of a prosodic pattern, and so forth. That is, in miniature, the law of reciprocity in action, and as I repeat, in action on the most extreme case, the case of inconsistency. On the surface, inconsistency which seems unresolvable, but is resolvable. The same holds, and here I don't have time to illustrate, for various other things that have been described as unacceptable, unreadable, uninterpretable, and so forth. Let me mention just one that is as famous as its field, perhaps even more famous than presupposition in pragmatics and the philosophy of language, and that is John Austin's speech act theory. Now, as you know, that speech act in this speech act theory, Austin from the beginning sets up what he calls felicity conditions. Felicity conditions, in other words, conditions that a statement has to meet in order to count as felicitous, as happy, as operative, or as acceptable. For example, a felicity condition would be, of a promise, would be that we mean to keep it. Another felicity condition would be that it is in our power to keep it, and so forth. Now, if a statement fails to meet those conditions, it is pronounced infelicitous, which is another variant of the same thing, unhappy. But again, suppose we come across, we read a novel, and there's a dialogue in which one speaker makes a promise which we know, right, because of the context, because of the information the narrator has given us, that promise is infelicitous. Now, we accept it as infelicitous in context. But the question is, do we stop here? Because the point about, as I mentioned earlier, the point about all these judgments of acceptability is that once you brand a statement as unacceptable, in any of these variants, unacceptable, unreadable, infelicitous, and so forth, this is a dead end. That is, there's nothing more to be done, right? Just throw it out. Now suppose we find that this statement that we met in the novel is infelicitous. Do we stop there? I would argue, and I hope you'll agree, that the exact contrary is true. That is only where our inferences begin. We ask, why is an infelicitous promise made? Or, we know that it is infelicitous, but does the maker of the promise know this? Does the addressee know this? What is the effect, if we're speaking about the narrative, what is the effect of that infelicitous promise on the narrative as a whole? For example, does it act as a trigger for an action? Or for a counteraction? For example, the addressee finds out that the promise has been infelicitous and he wants to take revenge. How many literary plots are built exactly on infelicitous promises? That is, whether or not we judge it as felicitous, then this is not the end of inference, the end of sense making, but the beginning. This may be the trigger. And I'm not now going to go into the other problems of these judgments of infelicitous, because those you'll be able to read about in a paper entitled If Plots, that John Pierce Anthology on Narrativity contains. I contributed, finished it a short time ago, so I won't come here and find him, you know, looking at me in a guilty, making me feel guilty and so forth. But for our purposes, this is enough. With speech acts as with presuppositions. There is no such thing as unacceptability in the sense that we can't explain it, and in the sense that there is no further work to be done, no further inference to be made, and so forth. Just a few quick parallels in other fields. Take ancient literature. Now, in ancient literature, one of the perhaps the tendency of traditional scholarship is, in effect, they don't put it in those words, not to accept the text they inherit. This is true of the Bible, and this is true of Homer. Everyone who knows about Homeric, traditional Homeric scholarship, or biblical scholarship knows that the main tradition is, or perhaps was, things have been changing, was instead of accepting the text as it is, to find it problematic. That is, to find it inconsistent, to find it discontinuous, to find it dark, to find it sometimes, people say, mistaken. And then to break it down into elements in order to save it from itself. And so we have, for example, the famous sources of the Bible, the documents, the traditions, and so forth, and the similar thing with Homer. Now, this shows even in smaller units. For example, you find scholars, as you find copyists 2,000 years ago, rewriting the text. That is, the text is not acceptable as it is. It doesn't make sense to them, so they correct it. An interesting example, one of my favorite, and a brief one, appears in the book of Samuel. It says, there are some biblical scholars here, Ben Shana Shaul Bemoncho. Saul was 1 year old when he came to the throne. 1 year old. Now, what do we do with this phrase? It is automatically corrected by everyone. Said 1 year old, so someone adds 20, 30, 40, and so forth. But look at what the rabbis did. The rabbis operated, if you like, on a rabbinic version of the law of reciprocity. But it was a rabbinic version because it was specific to the Bible. The Bible to them is divinely inspired. And therefore, there is no such thing as the Bible not making sense. So they said, and I quote literally, Ben Shana Latohar. He was one year old in purity, like a baby. In other words, they took the 1 year old not as an indication of time, but as a metaphor. And then, of course, it makes sense. What they said is, when he ascended the throne, if his whole past was, as it were, purged, and he began with a clean sheet, like a baby beginning life. Here you have an extreme example of a place where most of us would tend to say that some word has fallen out, but where's the will? There's a way, and where the rabbis had the will, they saved even this this hopeless-seeming verse from nonsense. Now, I'm not preaching an approach like the rabbis in every case. That is, it's not that we must always make sense of the text as given. That would be nonsense. For example, when we read each other's emails, then we automatically correct various spelling mistakes. We don't stop. Though if we stopped and tried to make sense of them, of the text as it stands, maybe we would reach, interesting conclusions. But we don't. We assume it's a spelling mistake, written in haste, and so forth, correct it and go on. But all I'm saying is this, that before we pronounce a sentence, a statement, a piece of discourse, a whole novel or poem is unacceptable, we must remember there are infinite ways of making sense, and we must always, when we apply the term unacceptable to a construction, we must always be aware that this is a hypothesis. When we correct this apparent spelling mistake, we can't be sure it is such. And ultimately, when I put my hand on my heart, I can't swear with absolute certitude that the rabbinic interpretation of Saul was 1 year old is incorrect. I can only say that it seems to me highly improbable. It's all hypothesis making. And when it comes to hypothesis making, we must be very careful of judgments of acceptability, even in particular cases, and we must avoid all such judgments as a matter of principle when we refer to whole constructions, when we refer to presuppositions, when we refer to speech acts, and we refer to problematic texts like the Bible, or like Homer, or if you like, a happy hunting ground for all kinds of corrections to Marcel's, to Proust's great novel. And it's perhaps time for me to pass now to the other principle, the protest principle, and point out, first of all, the logic behind it, and second, the relation to the law of reciprocity, and third, the implications for how we deal with discourse, especially with narrative. Now, the protest principle is named after that minor god in Homer. If you remember, Menelaus meets him, wants to get information out of him, but he changes shapes. He is first the old man of the sea, and then he changes into an animal, and then he changes into flowing water. He can't be pinned down. And it's after him that I've named this this principle. This principle, to put it in rigorous terms, says that between forms and functions, there is a many-to-many correspondence. Between forms and functions, there is a many-to-many correspondence. In plainer language, it means that every form can serve various functions, and every function can be served by various forms. Now, I want to illustrate this from several phenomena, but we don't have enough time, so let me just remind you of my talk last week. Last week I illustrated exactly this Proteus principle. I illustrated it from the question of narrative omniscience, because the Proteus principle is opposed to the current tendency that I call package dealing, that is pairing form with function in fixed combinations. If this form, then this function. If this function, then necessarily it comes with this form. The Proteus principle says exactly the opposite. The play between form and functions is in principle infinite, and we can't predict it in advance. We can only infer it after the fact, in the specific context of the specific discourse. Now, again, If this sounds to you simple or self-evident, I'm delighted. Because then we are again against a whole tradition, again with disciplinary and multidisciplinary and interdisciplinary ramifications, that says and does the very opposite, that package deals things together. But if we agree, let us be sure what we agree about. Let me spell out the implications of the Proteus principle. What the Proteus principle means is that in discourse there is a radical ambiguity. In other words, ambiguity is not a special case. Ambiguity is the special problem. Discourse is by definition ambiguous, and it is ambiguous precisely because when we face a piece of discourse, every piece of discourse, in the simplest conversation, everyday life, nothing is given, everything is inferred. In other words, we have to decide on the basis of the assumption that discourse is a goal-directed activity, that is, discourse always pursues some function. It may be a pragmatic function, like conveying information. It may be a poetic function, but it is always goal-directed. We must identify the function of that discourse, and we must pair it with the forms that perform, that realize that function. And as I think was shown beautifully in Madame Jacobi's talk last week, it is a question of a quest for the best fit. Which function fits which form in the best way? So, if we agree, as I hope, on the Proteus principle, please remember this implication. The assumption of radical ambiguity, which also means that in encountering every piece of discourse, we perform acts of inference, of hypothesis making, of fitting things together. Sometimes they're so easy that we do them in our stride, en passant. Sometimes, and this is what often happens, or most often happens in literary discourse and other artistic discourse, we become conscious of this because literary discourse poses problems, and I'll soon return to this from another angle, poses problems, and then we're sometimes tempted to think that this problematics of finding what does the discourse drive at and how does it achieve its aims and so forth is special to literary discourse. It isn't. What we have there only is a foregrounding of this universal of narrative, of discourse, a foregrounding of the problematics of ambiguity. Now this is also, and I hope I don't have to explain it in detail, this is also where the Proteus principle meets the law of reciprocity. Because the law of reciprocity complements the law or the Proteus principle in saying that whatever has been expressed can be explained. Only sometimes the explanations come easy, as they do in most of our ordinary exchanges, and sometimes the explanations are hard, and then they become conscious. Now, they are not the same because, let me remind you, the law of reciprocity need not contain only functional explanations. For example, to return to the copying mistakes, real or apparent, to the spelling errors and so forth, when we correct in passing, we read an email, we correct in passing a spelling mistake, and we say, ah, he didn't mean this, he meant that, and so forth. This is not a functional explanation. This is a genetic explanation. That is, we say, there was a mischance in the production of that message. And in this sense, the law of reciprocity is wider than the Proteus principle, which deals with the interplay, with the infinite interplay between forms and functions. Now, as I said, I actually apply this to omniscience, and I think now the family resemblance of Madame Jacobi's talk on reliability is also perhaps clearer. But let me now apply it to narrative theory at large, since we don't have so much time. And have you distributed? Here comes the embarrassing part. I have to indulge in a personal retrospect in order to explain, as I promised to the organizers. Let me keep it very brief. I entered the university at a very early age with certain preferences or interests in mind. I was in love with language, with words, with the history, with the etymology, with the wandering across different languages. I was in love with literature. I was in love with, I didn't know the word then, but with semiotic systems. But I was above all interested, even then I was interested in narrative, because narrative seemed to me the most complex discourse of all. More complex than poetry. And please make no mistake, I'm a great lover of poetry. Unfortunately, I haven't managed to write much about it. Actually, I wrote only one article with my wife on poetry. But it was very clear to me that if God gave me the opportunity, that's what I wanted to study. And I went on with it and spent the late 60s and the early 70s doing first a master's thesis and then a doctorate, which came out as my first book. You'll find it on the list of publications. It's Position, Modes, and Temporal Ordering in Fiction, trying to build up a comprehensive theory of narrative. That was by no means common in that time. I mean, a lot of my friends and teachers thought I was a little abnormal. There's so many interesting things to be done. And the point is that at the time, I looked for tools. I'm not too proud, you know, to get help from anyone who can give it to me. But there was very little, and that little left a lot to be desired. There was mainly, thank God, Aristotle's Poetics, the most important work on poetics ever written, but problematic for my purposes. I'll mention it later. There were the critical writings, especially the prefaces of Henry James, collected in a collection called The Art of the Novel, where he formulates his vision of a new novel, of course, based on point of view. This collection had a decisive influence on Anglo-Saxon modernism. It, in fact, dominated not only narrative study, not theory, there was no theory to speak of, narrative study, but also narrative practice, the writing of novels for the first half of the 20th century. There were the formalists, especially the work on narrative, what they called prose, and there were some newer things. There was, for example, a book that appeared in the early 60s, Wayne Booth's Rhetoric of Fiction, which was in a way an attempt to demolish and displace the Jamesian tradition. That is, the Jamesian tradition, I described it in my talk on omniscience briefly, the Jamesian tradition, which was for a restriction of perspective, which was for a minimization of the presence of the narrator, that is, dramatize, don't comment, and so forth, tell, don't show. And Booth tried to turn the wheel all the way by showing the advantages, the possible uses, and so forth, of a commentary in narrative. So all these were really useful in various ways, and I learned various things from them, but they did not supply me with the conceptual tools that I needed. And first of all, because they were all dogmatic. They were all too exclusive. In this sense, they were all against what I then felt, sensed, but didn't have the equipment to formulate. They were all against the Proteus principle. Because Aristotle has his restrictions. James, of course, had his restrictions. To him, the old novel was simply inartistic. Only his kind of novel, you know, based on this, on these dogmas of point of view, was an artwork. And Booth, of course, was exactly James, only the opposite. And again, this narrow centering on point of view, is this everything in narrative reduced finally to point of view, you know, to the exclusion of action, to the exclusion of equivalence patterns, to the exclusion even of linguistic art. And the formalists, of course, were dogmatic, but in their case, I'll soon specify this a little. Now, while I was working with these, I first encountered the French structuralists. And I still remember my amazement when I read them. Speaking about the late 60s, Raymond, Barthes, Genette, Todorov, an amazement. Because in them I found embodied the exact opposite of what I was driving at. The exact opposite, the mirror image. And this was even more surprising because there were points of contact. For example, I found that these people had been working parallel to me and unknown to each other on the question of time, which to me was central. And moreover, there was the connection to French, to Russian formalism, which is, by the way, the influence of Russian formalism on structuralism is much, much stronger and deeper than they acknowledge on the surface. This is a fascinating story. If you want to write the read the details, then I would refer you to item 48, the last one on this list, Chronology, Estrangement, and Stories of Literary History. There I tell the story in detail. But for my present purposes, this is not important. What I'm saying is I found the mirror image to what I was doing amid, you know, very surface continuities. Why the mirror image? For this, I have to return to Russian formalism. Now, I assume that you know that Russian formalism, unlike some of the pictures of it given in early histories, Russian formalism was not a homogeneous school or movement. In fact, it was torn by various, let's be polite, disagreements. There were also personal quarrels, there were also political and geopolitical quarrels and so forth. But for my present purpose, what is important is that the approach to narrative itself of the French formalists, Russian formalists, was divided among two lines. One of them was originated by Vladimir Pop in his famous Morphology of a Folk Tale, and the other was originated by Viktor Shklovsky in a long series of essays, the first of which was published in 1914, or the first well-known one, published in 1914, and that culminated in his book, The Theory of Prose, by the way, translated, of course, into French. The Theory of Prose, which was first published in 1925 and then republished in an extended edition in 1929, the last year of formalism. Formalism was killed violently by the Bolsheviks in 1929. Anyway, there were those two lines, and there was a pronounced, marked difference between them, but for my purposes, they were variations of the same theme. They were variations on what I call package theory. Now, let me briefly specify the statement. You remember Prop. Well, working on a corpus of folk tales, about 100 folk tales, he extrapolated from them 31 narrative acts. Ironically, he called them functions, but they are not functions in the sense of purposes, effects, and so forth. If they are functions, they are functions in the mathematical sense, which is very different. Anyway, he extracted those 31 narrative acts with a beginning that is a state of unhappiness, an end which is a state of happiness, and 29 acts which lead by a logic of action from one to the other. Now, I'm not concerned with the descriptive adequacy of Popsky. This has been debated by many, and interestingly, about 20 years ago, two French scholars proved that the scheme as it stands applies only to one of the folk tales in his collection, The Dragon Slayer. But never mind this this question. I mention it only because some of the continuators of the Prop tradition, by the way, the foremost continuator is, of course, Claude Bremont in the structuralist tradition, but he did not make this mistake of making this claim. Claimed that the scheme was universal. It applied to all narrative, or could be modified a little to apply to all narrative, which is, of course, nonsense. There are 31 acts on this sequence, and we know there is a basic rule which says that the more specific a thing is, the less a definition is, the less it covers, the less it includes, and vice versa. And when you have a sequence as specific as 31 acts and so forth, the chances that it will cover the whole of fiction, you know, amount to nil. But as I said, I'm not concerned with its descriptive adequacy. I'm concerned with something far more serious, and that is the question of the relation or lack of relation between forms and functions. And in this regard, Propp's sequence illustrates an approach to narrative that has no explanatory power whatsoever. And I distinguish descriptive power, that is, whether it covers the field, from explanatory power. What do I mean by explanatory power? Let's look again at the sequence. Anyone who knows his Aristotle will recognize that this is an expansion of Aristotle's chapter 7, where he speaks about a sequence that he calls the whole, made up. This is the most famous chapter of the Poetics. Every theory of plot is built on it. A beginning, a middle, and an end. Interestingly, if you read the Poetics carefully, you find that Aristotle often speaks not of a middle, but of middles in the plural, because according to his conception, the more middles there are, the better the work, the more artistic the work. So, what you have is the two, a recipient cut of points. You remember he says that the whole moves either from happiness to unhappiness, or from unhappiness to happiness, through intermediate links, middles, by probable or necessary sequence. Actually, what Propp did in this regard was he specified the middles. But while Aristotle allows a free movement between those two extremes of the human condition, that is, from unhappiness to happiness, or from happiness to unhappiness, Propp restricts the movement to one way. It's always from unhappiness to happiness. Why not the other way? Why not the other way? Now, the important thing is not that this question is unanswerable. Of course it's answerable. The important thing is that Propp not only doesn't raise it, but that it doesn't enter his conceptual scheme. It is not the kind of question he is concerned with. And of course we can say that the folk tale, like comedy, strives for a happy ending because that is part of its conventional functions. But he doesn't raise the question. And what I want to emphasize is that the fact that he doesn't raise the question affects not only leaves a hole in the scheme, the hole of explanation, but even affects the descriptive adequacy of the scheme. If you remember that when it comes to the cut-off points, he says that in the folk tale, the state of unhappiness often takes the form of a lack. Bremond then repeats it. A lack. In the folk tale, it is very often begins with a young man who lacks a wife. And then the end is correspondingly that this young man has found a wife, he is married. Now, why should the lack of a wife be identified with a state of unhappiness? I'm happily married, but many would say, I'm joking, but it's serious. Many would say that a lack of a wife is a state of happiness, or would not relate it either to happiness or to unhappiness. What I'm saying, in effect, is that the very definition of a link in this chain, which appears to be purely a matter of logic of action, is never purely a matter of logic of action. It is always also a matter of norms by which an act is judged to be thus or thus, for example, is judged to be a state of happiness, being single is a state of unhappiness, for example, and this affects the logic of action, because unless you have a normative ground for considering a state of singleness as a state of unhappiness, then the chain does not follow. Then he should, for example, what happens in the next stage? If he's in a state of unhappiness, then here begins the quest for a wife. The quest of a wife, which completes itself with a marriage. But then the trigger for going out into the world, leaving his country, leaving his village, and going out into the world to look for a wife, weakens. In other words, the logic of action is tied up to a teleologic, to a rationale of norms, of conventions, of judgments that make an action plausible or otherwise. And of course, that when we look at the analysis, we can see that, unlike Shklovsky, that is a single track analysis. In other words, what he speaks is in fact about Shklovsky's fabula only. And it is not the fabula, but the sujet, the other half, which contains the norms, just as it contains the perspectives, just as it contains the functions. What we have here, the sequence, is simply an inert logic of action, which awaits implementation in a system of norms, of perspectives, of context, of ideologies, which is the finished narrative text. And in Prop, there is no correlation whatsoever between those two sequences. Among other things, by the way, if you ask Prop, look, if you take the Odyssey, why does the Odyssey jump in medias res? Why does it begin in the middle of the sequence? He would shrug his shoulders, because within that system there is no correlation in time either, not just in perspective and so forth, no correlation whatsoever. In other words, what we have in Prop is the extreme case of forms without functions. And as I tried to show, this is not a matter of a lack, just a minus. Because if you don't have the functions, then your description of the forms is wrong as well, or faulty as well. It simply can't be done. Because a discourse is an interplay of forms and functions, and the functions define the forms, justify the forms, and at the first stage identify for us the forms, as we saw with the question of whether being single counts as a state of unhappiness. Now, Shklovsky is of course different in this case. Whatever we can say about him, we can't say that his is a functionless approach to narrative. The trouble with him is twofold. First, he recognizes only one function, and second, he marries that function to a certain form. Now, his one function is, of course, well known. It has made history. It is considered to be the basis of modern literary theory, and that is the function of estrangement. That is the topic of his first classic essay, Art as Device, where he, in a way, takes up the old romantic hunger for novelty and turns it into the universal of art. Not just of literature, of art. You remember those memorable sentences. He says, the function of art is to make us see again, hear again, because in everyday life everything is automatized. We don't really see, we don't really hear each other. It is, it's a function of art is to make the stone stony again, because in everyday life our perception is so flat and it's so cursory that we even don't see the stone as such. So first of all, this is the one function he recognizes, making strange, making unfamiliar, de-automatizing. And he marries this function to a certain narrative form. Now comes in his a famous distinction between the fabula and the sujet. The fabula being the reconstructed sequence of events in its chronological order, in the sense props sequence, and the sujet being the finished narrative product in its given order. I would add its given perspective, its given equivalence patterning, its given language, and so forth. And Shklovsky marries the that universal function of art to a sujet that breaks or distorts or deviates from the fabula. In other words, to him, the fabula, the chronological sequence, the order of events, represents the automatic, the thing that is not perceptible, the everyday. To make it strange, to make it perceptible, to break the automatism, you have to break the order of events by chronological distortion. And then the sujet is defined not as the finished product, whatever way it is finished, but as a finished product that is built upon a distortion of the fabula. That is why to Shklovsky, what he calls the most typical novel in word literature is the novel that to most people would be the least typical, perhaps the most untypical, and that is Lawrence Stern's Tristram Shandy, which is notorious for its mad jumps in time, which is notorious for its irresponsible narration, right? I mean, he makes promises and he doesn't keep them, and so forth. And it is, of course, the prototype of modernism. All modernists swear by Tristram Shandy. And he, Shklovsky, was the first, in fact, to present it as such. Why? Because Tristram Shandy, to him, embodies the most extreme distortion of the sujet on record, of the fabula in the sujet on record. So, if in prop we have forms without function, in Shklovsky we have a form wedded to a function. They go together. And we can easily see how mistaken that conception is. Again, I've written in that essay to which I referred to, I've written on it at length, but I think it can be explained very easily. Making strange is, by definition, a historical effect. That is, a device, a piece of language, a metaphor that is strange at one moment in history, loses its strangeness the more it is used, the more it becomes established, till it becomes a cliché and becomes dead. Now, what does it mean? Suppose Shklovsky is right, and at a certain point in history, readers have become used to the order of the fabula, to the chronological order. It is dead to them. They don't see the events. They don't see the interplay between event and character. Certainly they don't see the language. The language has become transparent. Then, indeed, the sujet, that will break the order of events, that will twist chronology, and with it, preferably perspective as well, and to throw in for good measure richly metaphoric language or otherwise problematic language, will of course revive perception, will make it strange. But the law of time, of course, rules. And suppose that this then becomes popular, this broken sujet, and it is again repeated and repeated and repeated and repeated. At a certain point, it will lose its strangeness, like everything else that is repeated too often, that becomes codified, that becomes stereotyped. And then what would be logically the most natural way of restoring perception? Of course, going to the opposite extreme and telling things in the order of occurrence again, because this has been forgotten. This is no longer familiar. A generation has gone by and people haven't seen anything like that. And if you think it's only a logical possibility, I would turn your attention again. I brought examples in that article. This is exactly what happened after modernism in the Anglo-Saxon world. After the sound and the fury, you know, of the experiments with time, whether in the form of the stream of consciousness or the form of the variously limited narrators, or just, you know, the kind of wild jumps performed by some of Faulkner's novels, you find some of those modernists, some of them quietly, some of them openly, saying, "We have gone too far. It has become too easy. We must now return to a traditional narrative." And in one case, there is a whole novel and we have the history on record, a whole novel, Tender is the Night, by Scott Fitzgerald, which was written in a way that Shklovsky would love, with a broken chronology and so forth. It appeared, it fell flat, and then what Fitzgerald did was he took the novel and he simply rewrote it into chronological order, because he understood that the time has come to return to chronology in order to make strange. That's exactly. The modernism has become the rule. The modernism no longer affected people as perceptible, as disautomatized. So I'm saying, you can see how this pairing of a function that nobody of us is likely to deny. Estrangement is a basic function of literature, not the only one, as Shklovsky thought, but certainly a basic function. It is the main force of literary history. And nobody of us here in this room is going to deny the art and the interest and so forth of chronological distortions and violations. My point is different. I don't want you to discount either of these. All I'm saying is that the package dealing of form and function is fatal, because the form of estrangement may be deviant chronologically, but given another context, given another point in time, the estranging form may be chronological. And the same holds, of course, for other things, for perspective. If to return to my talk of last week, just as we find after modernism a return to chronological narrative, we find a return to omniscient narration, because the limited point of view has, as it were, exhausted itself in its artistic possibilities and in its effect on the public. And suddenly, you know, the omniscient mode has become popular, and it is no accident that one of the most popular novels, of the artistic novels I speak, I mean, are in the 1960s, is John Fowles's The French Lieutenant's Woman, which is exactly a revival of omniscient narration, but it's not omniscient narration in the way the great novelist of the 19th century wrote it. It's omniscient narration with a difference. He says, "I am writing in an omniscient mode, but I'm writing not only after Dickens and Thackeray and Tolstoy, I'm also writing after Robespierre and Sartre." In other words, those who question omniscient narration, and then the making strange effect is in reusing omniscient narration, but with a new awareness that we will not find in the so-called naive use of the great novelist of the 19th century. Now, if you take these two violations of the Proteus principle, the forms without functions, and the package dealing of form and functions, I think you will understand. I think you will understand why I said that when I came across French structuralism, I found the mirror image. Because in French structuralism, I found those two things, the prop functionlessness, and the Schlosskin package dealing carried to an extreme. And none has carried them to such an extreme as did who, to my mind, the best of the structuralists, and which means the worst in this regard, Gérard Genet. In fact, his whole work on narrative discourse, the first book, and then the Narrative Discourse Revisited, is in effect a book-length exercise in package dealing. Sometimes, usually, of the Propian sort. You will find Genet deliberately throwing out any reference to functions. You will find it even in his choice of terminology. Perhaps you remember when he explains why he uses the key terms analepsis and prolepsis. He says, yes, I could use retrospection and prospection, but these terms, retrospection and anticipation, they have psychological consequences or psychological nuances, and I don't want to mix psychology with this. In fact, when he speaks about psychology, he speaks about the effect of those time jumps on our minds. He doesn't want anything to do with effect. So, since I want to speak a little about my response to these, I will just refer you to a paper where I analyze this whole thing, including Genet in detail, and that is Telling in Time 2. Telling in Time 2. Yes, item 39 on your list. And let me now outline how I finally came to implement the Proteus principle in my own approach. In telegraphic style, it goes like this. In all the approaches to narrative since Aristotle, narrative was defined by the object it represents. So, Aristotle was the first to speak of what we regard as narrative. He spoke about epic and drama as the representation of an action. In other words, narrative is defined by the action it represents. Now, this definition has gone down throughout the ages to the present day. I mentioned Genet. Genet starts by saying that a narrative is a representation of one or more events. You'll find the same among, story grammarians, to take an example which is far removed from Genet and people like him, in cognitive studies. Story grammarians. artificial intelligence researchers who have built story schemas. To them too, a story or a narrative is a representation of, some would say, an action, some would say an event, some would say two events, three events, some would say, for example, cognitivists would say a representation of an action in the form of a problem solving, right? That is, the beginning would then be a problem, the end would be the solution of that problem. And those definitions of narrative have invariably failed. They have failed because none has managed to explain what counts as an action. For example, in your handout, which unhappily I haven't come, in your handout, for example, look at verse 5. You have the son of David, Adonijah, who rises to, who aspires to the throne, saying, "I will be king." And he prepared for himself chariots and horsemen and 50 men to run before him. His father had never at any time displeased him by asking, "Why have you done thus and so?" He was also a very handsome man, and he was born next after Absalom. Now, how do we regard the sequence beginning with "he exalted himself, he prepared chariots to run before him," and so forth? Is it an action or isn't it an action? Now, to go by the usual markers, do we have here dynamic verbs? Yes. Do we have here a sequence? Yes. But still, if we read it in context, this counts as a description. This counts as a description, just like his description as the son of a certain woman, and the description that comes after of him as a handsome man. In other words, this sequence of apparent acts of exalting himself, preparing a carriage, and so on, is in fact a way of saying, in a dramatized fashion, he was ambitious. He wanted to seize the throne, as we see he tries to do, to seize the throne by force in his father's lifetime, and so forth. And there has been constant debate about what counts as an action. Some have tried to reduce it, for example, to a number of sentences. Gerald Prince, if you know him, he says an action is composed of three sentences. For example, John was unhappy, then he met Mary, then he became unhappy, or the reverse. Now you have three sentences, and he even specifies the relations between them, and so forth. Others say no. For example, William Labov, if you know his famous paper on storytelling in Harlem, he says no, there have to be two sentences, and not just two sentences, but two sentences whose order will correspond to the order of happening, and so forth. The debate is endless and will never be resolved, because again, actually, as I showed in regard to the sequence, to prop sequence, we cannot decide what an action is out of context. The context alone will make us classify a certain sequence of events as an action, and another one is here as a description. So, the traditional approach is a definition by the action. Now some, and this is very rare, like Monica Fludenig, if you know her book for the Natural Narratology, Monica Fludenig is an exception in that she defines narrative or narrativity by what she calls experientiality. That is, how we experience the finished discourse. This is in fact a neo-modernism, because it is a Jamesian definition of narrative, in that the experientiality is a matter of, in a way, feeling with the characters. We are exposed to their minds, and somehow we share the experience, enlarge upon it, and so forth. And then you'll find her performing acrobatics, very clever ones, because she's a remarkably clever analyst, to get rid of the action. Because that's always the problem. If you define narrative by its action, how do you pair it with a discourse? If you define narrative by its discourse, how do you pair it with the action? There is a hole in between, and what I'm claiming is this is the old familiar hole between form and function. The form of events, the prop sequence, Shklovsky's fabula, Genet's histoire, and all the rest, and then the narrative discourse which functionalizes those events, puts them to use. And so, unlike all those preceding definitions since Aristotle, I define narrative not by this or that, but by the relation between those two. According to my definition, narrativity lives here, in the interplay between fabula and the sujet, between the histoire and the discours, and all the others. And once you approach narrative by this interplay, suddenly you can extrapolate universals of narrative as I've done. In other words, our reading experience of narrative, whenever we read narrative, there is necessarily a discontinuity between our march, our movement, along the finished sequence. Suppose this is the sequence, we move this way, okay? There's always a discontinuity between the sequence upon which we move and the sequence that we reconstruct. We reconstruct this. In other words, we are confronted with an order of telling, and from this order of telling, we reconstruct an order of happening. This is what making sense of events means. Now, there's always a discontinuity, because even if the sujet doesn't deviate from the order of the telling, from the order of the event, even if it doesn't deviate, then we progress along it step by step, word by word, phrase by phrase, page by page, which means that, among other things, the future is always opaque to us. And here comes my first universal, the process or the dynamic of prospection. That is, when we read narrative, the future always forks out. We don't know how things will end, and so we make hypotheses about the end. When the order of presentation involves deviations from the order of happening, then we have another universal dynamics, which I call the dynamics of retrospection, and its paradigm would be the detective story, right? We progress along the discourse of the detective story, and we keep it, and we keep reconstructing the crime, because the discontinuity, the gap, is about who committed the crime, how did he commit it, and so forth. So we move forward, but our minds work backward, the dynamics of retrospection, in an attempt to reconstruct what happened. And third universal is what I call the dynamics of recognition. Now, the dynamics of recognition is also retrospective, but it depends upon difference between what I call perceptible and imperceptible gaps. In other words, if we take the detective story again, the gaps are perceptible, because we are immediately confronted with a mystery. There are questions: who committed the crime, why, and so forth, we know that there are things we don't know. But there are gaps of which we are not aware. In other words, we do not know that we do not know. And then we make assumptions. For example, we apply certain default premises. Or we simply assume things that are not there to be assumed. And then what happens is that only when that gap is closed do we discover that we didn't know things in the first place. Think of the surprises that you know in literature. Starting from Oedipus Rex, right? The surprise of the discovery, right? Step by step, that here we have the detective, the king, setting out to find out who committed the crime and ending up by discovering that the criminal is himself. Right? He didn't know that he didn't know. So, as I'm saying, in the interplay between the let's call it the sujet and the fabula, those three processes arise. They work all the time, and what's more important, they work on everything. That is, they don't work on events necessarily, they can equally operate on our reconstruction of a character. They can equally work on our reconstruction of a state of society. They can equally work on our reconstruction of a personal relationship and so forth, because everything in the world of narrative is subject to the step-by-step unfolding under the three processes of prospection, retrospection, and recognition, which I call for short suspense, curiosity, and surprise. Now, if you judge this theory, this is of course the heart of the theory. The rest is development. But if you judge this theory by the Proteus principle, you'll see what I mean by the many-to-many correspondence or many-to-many interplay of form and function. My claim is that these are the universal functions of narrative as a specific genre. There is no other genre that shares them, for the simple reason that there is no other genre that has two sequences correlated in this way. For example, a descriptive work, a descriptive poem, if it's in language, will of course unfold along a sequence. But it will not represent another sequence. It will represent a simultaneity, a space. And when the descriptive poem is translated into a painting, it will not even be sequential. So, these are the universal functions of narrative, and as I say, they can operate on everything in narrative, every component or subcomponent of the world of narrative. On the other hand, they can be manifested on the surface by an infinity of forms. And so then we needn't debate, you know, enter into this endless and hopeless debate of what counts as an action. Because what counts as an action is what operates on us as an action. In other words, what produces on us the effect of prospection and recognition and retrospection. The action is defined by its effect, not the other way around. It's not as if we had in advance an action and then we say, how does it act? In the order of our reading, in the reading process, first, we experience the effect, we experience suspense, or surprise, or curiosity, and then, of course, we map it on the elements of the text to make up an action in the fabula. So in this sense, mine is, I claim, not only the only available narrative theory that has explanatory power, because it deals with the interplay between form and function, and that is the only thing that a narrative is distinctive for. In other words, if you'd like me to put it bluntly, my problem with structuralism, which was to me the main antagonist in those formative years, the problem with structuralism was that it was an anti-structural structuralism, because structure is by definition, not my definition, the structuralist's own definition, structure is a matter of part-whole relations. And part-whole relations are the same as an explanatory principle, and the explanatory principle is the same as an interplay of form and function. If you think about it, you'll see that these are all synonymous expressions of the same thing. For example, to illustrate the negative way, if you reach the end of Genet's narrative discourse, you'll find another, you know, to my mind, astonishing a statement. He says something like, people now expect me to show how all the devices that I illustrated from a post-recherche, the analepsis and the prolepsis and the paralepsis and so forth, how they all come together. And I think that every reader who regards this as a work of structuralism says, of course, because structuralism is about part-whole relations. But he says, no, I'm not going to do it. The point is, he couldn't do it even if he wanted to, because he has no explanatory principle that will bring all those parts together. He can only break down the work into here a analepsis, here a prolepsis, here this, here that. For part-whole relations, you need an explanatory principle. And the explanatory principle can't be in the forms themselves, because the forms are, by his own analysis, the forms are decomposable. The finished work is decomposable into those different forms. In order to have an explanatory principle, you have to have a functional principle, a teleology. And what you have instead there is a typology without a teleology. If you like, an updated, discourse-oriented version of Propp. What I offer is the exact opposite. I offer is a set of universal functions of narrative that are mappable onto a variety of forms. Again, to mention one thing in this handout, I won't even read it, just mention it. Okay, one sentence. The adjectives, you'll find in the opening sentences a number of adjectives. Now, in the Bible, adjectives are proleptive. In other words, when we come across an adjective applied to a character, a woman is described as beautiful, David is described as old, and so forth, we know two things. One of them is that adjective will explode into action sooner or later, and in this sense, once the adjective appears, we form a prediction about the future. It arouses suspense, in other words. Now, according to all conventional typologies, an adjective is anti-narrative. It is descriptive. In my theory, there is no problem. I don't care whether the narrative function is fulfilled by an adjective or is filled by a verb, whether it's filled by description or whether it's filled by an action. Because, as I say, the Proteus principle says there is an infinite interplay between forms and function. Any form can be used to fulfill the narrative function, which is, in my concluding sentence, also means that when forms that are in themselves not narrative, like adjectives, like patterns of equivalence that are not narrative, analogies right? Similarities. Even language. Language is not a peculiarity of narrative. When those non-narrative elements enter narrative, they all become narrativized. In this sense, they operate in a different way from the way they do outside narrative, because once they enter narrative, they enter into these three processes. Suddenly, for example, when we have a pattern of equivalence.
No more example.
Okay, just a sentence. We have a pattern of equivalence. It is a static pattern. X is like Y. But in narrative, what we find is that X is like Y at one stage, but under the changes in the narrative process, it can become X is unlike Y at the other stage. That is, in a nutshell, the picture that I can unfold here. We are still working on it. There is still a lot to be done, despite, I mean, this long list of publications and other publications that are associated with it. There's a lot of work to be done, and I would be happy if some of you find it interesting enough to take up part of the work. I myself, as I said at the beginning, have not yet finished my own part, and if we meet again, or when we meet again, as I hope we do, I will report on developments. Meanwhile, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We have to run.
Thank you very much.
This is another example of how the administration takes over, you know, and dictates to the academy. Insupportable.
No, no, no.
Pardon?